This week on The Stack, we give you the ultimate guide to indie publishing, plus a beautiful biennial title reporting on contemporary art, and the first edition of a new design publication, Eye on Design. Stay tuned. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up on the show, a book that will show you how to create your own magazine. And of course, we have a beautiful art title showcasing the best of Polish talent. But first, let's talk about Eye on Design, which is a new beautiful design title that will be published 3 times a year, and the theme for their first ever print issue is Invisible. The magazine is published by AIGA, a professional association for design, which is the oldest and largest in the US. I spoke to Perrin Drum, the title's founder and editorial director, and also Meg Miller, its senior editor, and they explain what exactly is Eye on Design.
Whether it's print, online, or at one of our in-person events, Eye on Design is all about telling the stories of the world's most exciting designers and the issues that they care about. That means we cover the best work period, whether it's by a student or by an older seasoned pro. And then we peer through that graphic design and visual communication lens, so to speak, and tell the wider stories about the world, stories about design and sexuality, politics, mental health, diversity, education, cities, music, on and on, anything that a designer would also be interested in, but from their point of view.
And then I guess you decided it was about time perhaps to have a print magazine as well on design, right?
Yeah, that was a very exciting moment to come to. So let me backtrack just a second and answer that first by noting that we're published by AIGA, which is a nonprofit that's not only the oldest graphic design organization in the country, but it's the biggest one too. It's made up of over 20,000 members who are all practicing designers themselves. And in addition to that membership base of support, we build up a really strong online readership and social following around Eye on Design. So we were humming along nicely doing that for about 2 years, and then a couple things happened. One is that we started telling bigger stories that needed a little bit more room to breathe than our site's templates would allow. We love our templates. They're awesome. We love our website. But we wanted to use print as our long-form medium of choice and as also kind of a play space to experiment with storytelling and with what design could do on the page, give us a little bit of freedom there. The other thing that happened is that we heard from our members. These are designers who love print and love paper, and they were yearning for a print publication to come out of AIGA again. We used to publish the AIGA Journal, and Steve Heller was the last editor to helm that, but funding dried up in the 90s. And so since then, AIGA hasn't really published much, and so our members have really been wanting something print to hold in their hands. And then being editors ourselves who love magazines and who all come from big media, we actually all quit our jobs at these bigger publishing companies to come work for a small arts nonprofit that would trust us and give us autonomy to kind of do our own thing. So with that authority, we decided to start Eye on Design magazine. And the timing ended up being pretty ideal as far as market opportunity is concerned. We knew there was already a gap for a quality design pub. Most of the ones on the newsstand were either quite academic or more trade-focused or just were feeling a little dusty in their approach, maybe. And then, sadly, print folded, which, of course, we couldn't have predicted, but it just made it feel like the right time for us to step up or at least attempt to step up as a new voice with something smart and fun to say about graphic design.
Well, I'm glad you guys decided to go for print. And if I move on now to Meg Miller as well, let's talk about the first issue which I have in hands. First of all, I have to say it looks very beautiful and it's an Eye on Design. As you can see, I think the listeners should grab a copy. I love the design. Tell us a bit more about the first issue.
Sure. The first issue is themed around invisible, which might seem a little counterintuitive for a design magazine, design being the profession that makes messages and systems and ideas visible. But actually, it became a pretty interesting framework for us to think about how we wanted to cover design for the first print issue. So a lot of our coverage revolves around the code and data and grids lurking behind our interfaces. We also cover a lot of issues of representation in design education and in the professional world. And we also touched on some other intangible subjects like identity and mental health and those unsung heroes of the design world that you don't normally hear from.
And Meg, is the idea that every issue will be designed by someone different? So for example, for those who are already looking forward to see issue 2, actually might not look the same as issue 1.
Yep, that's a big part of our publishing model. So besides the obvious, which is that it's fun and exciting to publish a magazine that looks completely different every time it comes out, we also were thinking about it as a way to sort of put our money where our mouth is, so to speak. We cover designers all day. We speak to these people who we admire their work, follow them, talk to them about what the biggest issues are to them and sort of what discussions that they're hearing in the design world. And so with the magazine, we were thinking we can hand over the magazine and say, we believe in your work, we believe in your vision, design this cover to cover. So for the first issue, we did it with Maziar Pahlavan, who is a designer whose work we really admire, who we've been following for years. And it was really fun to work with him on this issue because he has this really monochromatic style. He works a lot with type in fun ways, and he did a really incredible job with this first issue. And it also speaks, I think, to the way that we're thinking about the magazine differently than we are online, because I think online, for someone like Maziar, we would probably profile him, talk to him about his practice, talk to him about his work, show some of his work. With the magazine, we're asking him to become a collaborator with us and commissioning him to actually design this printed object that will showcase his work that way.
And Perrin, if I move on now to you, for those who are interested to have a copy of the magazine, how is the distribution process of the magazine? Because clearly it's a non-profit. I want to understand a bit more about your business model.
Distribution, the most fun part of making a magazine. Right now we are selling online and doing subscriptions online as well. And just through individual sales and subs, the magazine more than pays for itself. So we're earning our keep in that way. But that's only made possible because we're able to keep our overhead low by working with some really amazing and generous partners who are keen to support AIGA's first foray back into print in over 2 decades. So Google Design has come on board as patrons. Mohawk has donated all of our beautiful paper. I think Meg and I can't tell you how exciting it is for us to be able to hand our designer the Mohawk sample book and just say, here, pick whatever you want. And then Hemlock, our printer located in Vancouver, has been so amazing, really working side by side with us as sort of newbies in our first mag. And now for issue number 2, we are looking into some proper distribution instead of handling all of the outreach to retailers ourselves, which anyone can tell you can get a little bit of an administrative nightmare. So yeah, we're looking on to bring European and US distribution for the next issue.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. So is that what you guys want as well, to have readers not only in the US, but all around the world?
Oh, totally, yeah. Online, we actually have a search function that lets you sort stories by country and by location. AIGA is a very American organization, but iDesign has always wanted to cast a global eye. It's really important for us. It's why we work. Our team is really global. We're New York, London, Berlin, and Beirut. Maziar, that Meg mentioned, is from Iran. Our next designer is also not originally from the United States. And yeah, it's just important for us to tell the global design story as well.
Listeners of The Stack are certainly curious about the world of magazines and newspapers, and some of them, I'm quite sure, they're very interested to find out how to make their own magazine, or perhaps they just want to hear some tips on how to make it in the world of indie publishing. Worry no more, because we have here writer Connor Purcell, who just published the book The Magazine Blueprint, The Ultimate Guide to Indie Publishing. Monaco Stone Edwards spoke to him on when the plans for the book started.
Well, I've been planning the book for 3 or 4 years. It's just taken me this long to actually do it. And then it sort of spiraled out of control. I kept interviewing more and more and more people. And eventually I had to say, I got to stop doing this because I could have gone on forever, really. So I interviewed 50 people, and at that stage I thought, okay, that's a nice round, even number. And then I started writing it and putting it to shape. So it did take a while, but the initial reason was when I started out making independent magazines, there wasn't anything like that on the market. Mm. And there have been a few very good books about independent publishing, but it's always been focused more on the graphic design side, and they've been almost coffee table books, whereas I wanted this to be very much a hands-on manual to making a magazine.
Well, and to that end, obviously the structure is about getting started, going through processes like design, cover selection. But I think critically, you know, where's the money? It's very explicit. Build it and they won't come is your chapter heading. And this is about things like distribution, of course, where often these things fall down. I sense from what you say, that was always front and centre to really, this is about making something that's a viable business model. It's not the sort of dreamy follow your vision. This is a proper, well, it's a proper kind of business oriented title as much as anything.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's important that people go in with their eyes open about how difficult it is to create a magazine and then make it sustainable. And obviously there's lots of people and lots of interviews where people are saying, you know, follow your dreams, go and do it, it's great. But, you know, that's really, the creation part is only 50%. The other side in some ways is more important, which is building an audience, selling to that audience, creating something sustainable, getting organized, making sure you're in the right shops, being aware of distribution models and how it's all stacked towards the main publishers and not towards indie titles, how your model will differ from, say, a mainstream travel title, for example. So I think being aware of all that is really important. And once you do that and go in with your eyes open, you're more realistic and you can plan out 2 or 3 years issue plans. And I think then it becomes a lot more rewarding and you learn a lot more when you do it as well.
It's kind of less sexy in a way, but it's a truism, I suppose, that you have to be a business person as much as a publisher or a designer or an editor. Do you think there are still people who maybe go into the sort of world of independent publishing not aware enough of those kind of commercial imperatives?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it really hits home when you get, 1,000 or 2,000 copies of your magazine shipped to your house in cardboard boxes and you think, oh God, now I have to sell all these. How am I going to do that? So the reality hits home there. And obviously friends, family will buy a few copies. But for it to be sustainable, it has to be in the shops. People have to be aware of your website. You have to have, I think, a really sort of a vital and drive to tell stories and to have a reason for doing this. Not just, I don't think saying I want to create a magazine is enough of a reason. You need to have a really strong reason and foundation to do it. And if you do that, then I think when you do hit muddied waters and trouble and there's always going to be problems, you'll stick through it. But if the only reason you're doing it is just to create a magazine, to have something cool to show to your friends, at the first sign of trouble, you'll probably give up. And that's, in my view, worse than not starting at all.
Wise words indeed. Let's talk a bit. You mentioned the 50 people you spoke to, and there's some good friends of the Stack in there, titles, you know, Gourmand and so on, that we are beloved of us here at Midori House. How did you go about that list? I mean, I sensed it grew quickly and you spoke to us. You were so hungry to talk to people. But how did you pick? Was it the people behind your favourite magazines? What was the process like?
Yeah, pretty much the magazines I like. And I wanted to do a mixture of not just indie titles. I wanted people that worked in so-called mainstream titles. So people like Adam Moss at New York Magazine, Gail Bichler at the New York Times Magazine, people like that, because I think there is a tendency to overlook the great work and the great design and great editorial packaging in the mainstream titles as well. I think sometimes they get a bad rap. So I didn't want it to be just a ghetto of indie publishing, because I think both sides can learn from each other. So, and then it was just a case of emailing people, and virtually everybody agreed to be in it. So people like George Lois immediately said yes, Stephen Heller, kind of design legends, David Carson, people like that, as well as the indie publishers. So I wanted sort of a broad church of people, so it wasn't just indie people, because I think particularly in sort of independent magazines, there's less of a focus on the actual business of an editing. What is an editor? What makes a great magazine? And maybe too much focus on design. So I wanted to make sure there was a lot of in the book about how to edit, how to write, how to sub-edit, which I think is sometimes overlooked.
Indeed. And I wonder, is there something particularly sort of sherry about, certainly we know that's true, I think, in the independent publishing space, but the fact that, you know, you mentioned you drop a note to some of these luminaries, even working at big international titles, and they're happy to share some insights, they're happy to share their time, which is very precious. Why is that? Are people kind of bonded by this more fundamental love of print, do you think? It seems, I can imagine other creative industries, people being a bit more guarded about giving away their trade secrets, but it's always struck me ready to share people are. Why do you think that might be?
I think they all share a passion for print and maybe, you know, they thought, God, who's this idiot who's going to write a book? I feel sorry for him. I better give him, you know, 10 minutes of my time. And also when I went to New York and I went to different cities and interviewed people on the ground. So I think it was easier then if I said I was going to travel all the way from Dublin to New York, it was easier for them to say, OK, I'll give you half an hour. And yeah, and I think also people like to be in a book. You know, it's a bit more solid than in a magazine, and to be quoted in a book, I think people like that. So and I think just people are nice and they want to share their information, and you know, and generally I think people are more willing to help than not.
And let me ask you a bit more about some of the detail. Like, you have these sort of blue type breakouts which have little kind of data hints, guide structures, there's sort of timelines and that kind of thing. Was it important to you that the book delivers on that front? You know, people could almost, I'm not suggesting they desecrate this beautiful edition, but you know, you could almost tear out those pages
and
have them taped off on your desk in front of you. It's super hands-on. And I guess I sense from all you said so far, that was important. This, you want this to really be a template for someone to go and have a bash at this.
Definitely. I mean, ideally, I'd love to see this, as you said, battered and bruised, sitting on someone's desk who's used it for their own magazine. I don't want it to be read it once and put it away in the shelf or a coffee table book. It's meant to be used. And I was aware of there's a lot of text in it, so I wanted to have those sort of breakouts and pull out quotes and little tables and charts to sort of give people a way to access the information as easy as possible. I designed the book myself. I'm not a trained designer, so I had to keep it as simple as possible. And I was trying to think about how would I, 5 or 10 years ago, what sort of book and what sort of packaging would appeal to me, what would help me the most. So that was sort of the guiding tool when I was designing it.
It's very nice. It's certainly coffee table-able if you wanted. I know that's not what it's designed for, but it's nice enough to do it. And the design is very, very polished. Let's talk a bit more about the, you know, where's the money? Follow the money. And there's sections in here about the need to add, you know, layers of complexity to sort of any media brand. And it's funny, you know, we're sat here in Monaco, you talk actually right at the end of the book about, you know, what about podcasts? This is something that's monetizable, very popular. And we're sitting here on a podcast right from Monaco 24, the audio arm of Monaco and so on. And obviously Tyler's wisdoms are peppered through the book as well. Are there still undiscovered additional layers, do you think? I mean, obviously you can have retail models, you can have podcasts. Do you think that there will be clever publishers, savvy publishers who can find even new envelopes to push, or are we kind of almost at the maximum level?
I think it really depends on each individual brand. And I know that there is sort of an obsession with having as many different channels and as many different add-ons and brand extensions as possible. But I do mention in the book the famous adult magazine, Penthouse Magazine, which was making at one point millions and millions of dollars a month in the 70s and early 80s. And the publisher Bob Guccione basically wasted huge amounts of money on brand extensions. Airlines, they invested $20 million in Caligula, which is a sort of a disaster of a movie. So I think people have to be careful about why they're doing it. I think the magazine should be part of the overall, maybe the centre of what they're doing. But it's very difficult to survive as an independent publisher with just a magazine. And I think some of the smartest publishers look at delayed gratification. They put on infographic courses. You can, as you said, you can have podcasts, but you always need to think about where is the money going to come for this? If we get podcasts, will we get advertisers? And we'll need to build up an audience of, say, 50,000 downloads. How long will that take? And how many hours work will that take? So it's always looking at, could we do something else to get that revenue? Maybe it would be events. So I think it's a very personal decision for each publisher. And maybe it's looking at something like content marketing, which, you know, every brand now wants to be produce content. So maybe it's publishing magazines for brands. I mean, there isn't really any ceiling on what you can do, but it's always a case of figuring out how much time you have and how much money this is going to cost you.
Well, let's talk about that idea, time and money. Now, again, on this program, we often come back to this theme about, you know, the demise of print is overstated. But nevertheless, we know there are contractions, whether it's in broadsheet newspapers, in the independent sector. Yeah, there's a reassuringly high number of new entrants into the market every year. But then there's also titles being shuttered, even some of our favourites. If we take a step back and look at that big picture, particularly now you've produced this sort of primer, are you reassured about the kind of next generation, if you like, the hungry youngsters who are going to have the next wave of innovative ideas, that they are coming through in number and in quality enough, and that they'll continue to do so?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, even if you look at indie publishing say, 5 years ago, when a lot of the magazines were being criticized for being about nothing. So interviews with graphic designers, coffee shop owners, lots of white space, thick matte paper, very collectible, but ultimately fairly empty. They didn't really have a point of view. And if you look at some of the more recent titles in the last 2 years, there's magazines about gender, queer issues, feminism, politics. They really have a strong opinion. Magazines like Accent, Ladybeard, and the design is much less polished. It's more raucous design. They're very much political magazines in the tradition of magazines like Oz and things from the 1970s. The muckraking magazines in the States in the 60s, the sort of counterculture magazines. And I think that's really interesting. They're cheaper to produce now than ever before. They come out more frequently, so it's not a biannual thing to keep and as an object. It's more something to use and to read and to share. So I think that sort of change has been very interesting in the last few years. And I think generally young people are getting more political. This generation is probably a lot more political than my generation was at 20 in the late 90s, for example, when there wasn't that much to be political about. So I think that's probably where it will go. And I think as you know, more and more people are used to having a voice now on Twitter and social media. They're used to expressing their opinions. And this, I think, using an independent magazine is another way of doing that, and maybe something that's more tangible than a tweet or a blog post.
Thanks, Tone. And remember, you can buy copies of The Magazine Blueprint on www.themagazineblueprint.com. And finally on the show, a really striking publication about the art world. It's called Contemporary Links. The biennial title reports on art, design, photography and collecting, and it serves the purpose of being a guide to contemporary culture in Poland. I spoke to Sylwia Krasen, one of the editors-in-chief for Contemporary Links.
Yes, this issue is very colorful, but that was our intention, because the main topic of the issue is art for all. And every time we create a new issue, we're trying to have a main theme, a leading theme, which we use. And around this theme, we create content and curate the content of the whole magazine. So for this issue, our buzzwords were art for all, art seen as a democratic space, and art as a part of our everyday life.
So the magazine is also some kind of a platform to showcase the Polish creative scene around the world. Is this more or less what it is?
Yes, that's our mission. And what we wanted to do is to give a voice to Polish artistic community and to show that Polish scene is very vibrant and very interesting. It could be interesting for lots of foreigners and not just for Polish people.
And tell us about when you decided to start the magazine, because I know you're the co-founder and you're based in the UK and the other editor is also in Warsaw. But tell us, how does it work?
So it all started 2013 with my friend Dobromiła Błaszczyk, who's a co-founder and also editor-in-chief. We studied together history of art in Kraków at the Jagiellonian University. And later I moved to London and she stayed in Kraków. So we work, she worked in art gallery, and I also work in different positions in London and also in galleries and always being linked to art scene. And then we started to see there's lack of information in English about Polish artists. So we thought we need to change it. And we started as a blog, like normal WordPress website, where we were uploading our articles in English about interesting artists, mostly who exhibit outside Poland, just because there were lots of that time magazines and blogs about artists and exhibitions inside the country, but no one really captured what's going on in Polish art scene in Berlin, in London, in New York, Chicago, where Polish people actually usually are a large group of people living in this country and now in the whole Europe actually.
And do you think this is a good showcase of also of Poland's soft power as well, you know, because it's interesting. And I want to talk about the publishing scene. I wonder if you know much about it. We had an interview with the editor-in-chief of Vogue Poland, which is a new publication in the country. Do you think it's a country that is actually welcoming, you know, more art or more magazines and this kind of things?
I believe like big cities like Warsaw, Wrocław, Gdańsk, Poznań are really interesting places to be, and that independent magazine scene is up and coming. We even did some panel discussions and invited editors from different indie magazines to discuss different topics and discuss their journey through printed magazines. So yes, I would say it is some interesting topic to explore, and more magazines are printed magazines are popular in Poland with special focus. Like, I like the one about fathers, or Vogue is something new in Poland. So yes, I think it is lots of going on.
And tell us a bit more details about the magazine itself. How often does it come out, and where are you selling it? Is it quite international, or do you sell a lot to the Polish market?
Contemporary Links is printed twice a year, in April and October. Apart from that, we do weekly online magazine. So every week we publish news stories and interviews, quotation and photo stories. But coming back to the print magazine, we are, I think, part of the slow publishing movement where we really work closely with artists. And even every time we create a new cover of the magazine, it's an idea which come from the artist. We invited, for instance, in this issue, Marta Antoniak, visual artist based in Kraków, designed for us the cover with the set of stickers. So it's a very fun and engaging way to start the reading, just because you can customize your cover and rearrange it to a completely new image, where inside you can get this set of stickers and make your own cover. So that was kind of our idea to make it more engaging. As I said, we tend to have main team every time. So this means that we don't write only about Polish artists. We're trying to show them in the international context, and we're trying to present them in around the international scene, that the Polish artists don't live in a bubble and in a Polish community only. So we write a lot about international artists as well. Like this time, we interview Gilben and George because they have 50th anniversary of their life and work. And we thought that it's such a brilliant idea to feature their work. The same with Martin Parr or with lots of emerging international artists. When you write about essays...
It's impressive names, I have to say. Yes. Really big names.
At the same time, we have lots of Polish artists like Alicja Bielawska or Mariusz Tarkawian, who created for us drawings, especially for this issue. So every time we're trying to combine this Polish community with international community.
I'm curious, why Links?
It's actually a funny story, because domain should have a name, Contemporary Links, with L-I-N-K-S. Which means that we wanted to link Polish artists with international art world. However, it was taken. So lynx is an animal, it's a creature, it's a cat, which got really sharp eyesight. And we thought it's going to be an amazing analogy to Polish art scene, which is elusive. It's like lynx is very elusive creatures.
Do you have lynxes in Poland?
Yes, we have lynxes in Poland as well. Very special cats. And these cats are elusive, and no one knows much about their lifestyle. And we thought it's a nice analogy to Polish art scene, which is also elusive, and not many people know about it from the outside.
There was Sylvia Krasen there. You can find more about the title on contemporarylinks.co.uk. And remember, links is L-Y-N-X. The title is available also across galleries in Europe, US and Asia. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editors Cassie Galpin and Sarah Miles as well. If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to write to me on fp@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com or on iTunes as well. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.